The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
How are you, sir?
This is Peter.
Oh.
I can't believe I'm talking to you, Dr. Ray the Great.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I love listening to you. You have a personality just like my father.
I don't think you should feel helpless. You are helpless.
Doctor, I really appreciate that. That makes me feel a lot better.
You be at peace, or else I'm going to yell at you.
Trying to find a reason to speak to you. I think you're the best thing since sliced bread.
That Ray, he's something.
Thank you so much for what you're doing for all the parents out there.
They don't know what I can possibly do.
I don't either.
I'm getting my money worth, I think, at this phone call.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Expanding your ego while shrinking your id. Everybody has to carry an ID card, you know, your id card. And they were telling me in grad school, I remember we even had a section in one of our personality courses talked about when you're a therapist, you have to look the therapist. You have to sound the therapist. That in and of itself is salutary. It can be helpful. It's the image, the perception that goes with it. And I've decided on this radio program, a lot of times as you can see from those early bumper comments, I stumble around a lot. I really quite don't know what to say, when to say it, how to say it. So I'm going to alter my persona. The stereotype of the Victorian age Austrian psychiatrist. Well, I think you have a loose apple in the strudel. If I could throw in a few more of those, and maybe have a gray goatee, I think that I could get a little more mileage out of my advice. To get onto the program, that would be 877-573-7825. 877-57 equal, if you want to break it down into bite-sized bits, 877-57 equal. If you would like to get onto the program, if you have a question about something in your life, a comment about a previous caller or something in their lives, you could do that. You can help them out. If you disagree with me, if you're willing to be wrong, that's up to you. But you can disagree with me, and we'll put you straight to the front of the line. Sometimes people have generic questions where faith and psychology interact. I'm a clinical psychologist. I spent much of the week this week at the office. Used to do that all the time. I have full-time, 40, 50 hours a week practice, consulting, school districts, different places. Now it's sort of a mix. Some writing, some speaking, some media. Still see clients, though. You get stale if you don't. If you just become a media shrink, you definitely become stale. There's no question. You don't have your finger on the pulse of what's going on out there for a lot of folks. So, the number, 877-57-EQUAL. I used to get emails from a delightful woman in Poland. She had a PhD in, I think it was in English or some type of writing curricula. She was brilliant. Her emails were, in and of themselves, I could have put them all together and made a book out of them. She was absolutely delightful with her personality and her intellect. Her name was Nell. One of the programs I talked about getting in big trouble, in a workshop that I had done for some teachers. And I talked about writing as a possible consequence for misconduct. Essay, something along those lines, an apology. Well, I got skewered, flat out skewered. And I told him, I said, hey, send me a letter, you know. How dare I? How dare I use their profession, their coursework, as punishment? How awful. That would make kids just hate writing. Nell heard that, and she wrote me and said she had a very interesting experience in her grad school. The professor said, all of you are in a PhD program. for various levels of writing skills. And these people were going on to get their degrees in English and literature, and writing was at the very, very center of their education. He said, in so many words, "You're not eighth graders. You are professionals." So, and this particular, I forget the course, it was a literary course. "You are not going to be assigned particular writing exercises. You can decide whether you want to turn them in. You're grown-ups. You're professionals. You shouldn't have to be pushed into completing assignments. This is not middle school." Nell said that initially they were very, very pleased at this professor's philosophy. How true. We can decide whether we want to write on this subject or that subject as they come up in class. And Nell said that as the course progressed, as time went on, less and less assignments were handed in. What? But they were supposed to be self-motivated. These are professionals. These are people pursuing a PhD in writing skills. What? She made the observation that even at that level, they had to be nudged, pushed, required. "I write. It is the hardest thing I do. The phrase is, if something was hard to write, it is easier to read," or vice versa. "It is, if something is easy to read, it was hard to write. Writing is the hardest thing I do. It takes incredible self-discipline, and you have to look at this particular page, this particular paragraph, this particular flow, and decide, does this make sense? Does it read easily? Would somebody look at this and react, huh? I don't know what he said." It is enormous discipline. It isn't something where I say, oh, goody. Oh, goody. Let's see, would I rather eat a pizza and read a novel or sit down at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee and write for 2 hours? Interestingly enough, one time I used to do a lot of teacher in-services. A lot. I mean, many, sometimes two and three a day during certain times of the year. Those are pretty much all passed for a lot of reasons. A lot of school districts don't bring in outside speakers like they used to. And one of the questions was raised after a session. Aren't you nervous with the English teachers here, the literature teachers, that when you discuss a child having to write an apology or write an essay on some subject regarding their conduct, that really is going to be a detriment to the teachers? I mean, you're forcing these kids to do this. You're turning them off towards the joy of writing. So I asked these questions. Would the literature teachers please raise their hand? And, you know, several did. I said, at the beginning of the year, which it was, what if you went to class and said, no one in here will be required to write? I want you to write on the basis of your desire to write. You will neither get an A, B, C, or D, or flunk the class if you do not turn in assignments. And, of course, by the looks on their faces, it was, well, that's totally unworkable, totally unrealistic. I said, so let me see if I understand this. If they don't turn in the assignments, you will flunk them? Well, isn't that forcing children to write under penalty? I thought you wanted them just to enjoy writing for the sake of writing. Why are you forcing them to write? Why are you giving them assignments and then saying if they're not turned in, you get a zero? Or if they're turned in poorly, they'll be graded down. That's coercion, isn't it? The story is told of a high-profile author who was going to give a speech to young budding writers on how he was going to teach them to be better writers. Ooh, they were ready. They had their notepads all sitting on their lap. And he got up. He said, "What are you doing here? Go home and write. That is how you will be a better writer." My first book was a book titled "You're a Better Parent Than You Think." I wrote it, I was in my 20s. It took me 3 years. It took 3 years to write that book. The books since then have come in shorter and shorter periods of time. Is that because I've devoted more time to writing the book? No. It's because I had more practice. And so when I put my first rough draft down, it's not as rough as it used to be. It doesn't take as much pounding and editing as it used to take. Why? Well, because I practiced. It is the biggest myth in the world. Well, okay, not in the world. There is no God is the biggest myth in the world. But it is maybe one of the big myths of the educational world that says a child has to write. They will hate writing. They will never again put a pencil, pen to paper. Go to the computer, type it in. And by the way, I write all of my stuff longhand. And I always felt like when I did that, it helped more than just clattering on the keys. And then I saw some research that said there's something about the fine motor impulse, the signal that goes to your brain. When you do this, when you actually take your hand and write out your thoughts, there is a certain amount of connection, I guess you'd call it, between your brain and your hand and your thoughts on paper that actually make the writing better. That was my own informal experience, but it was nice to see some kind of research confirmation of that. Oh boy, I talked way too long. I should have written all this down. 877-573-7825. I'd like to talk to you if you'd like to talk to me. You don't have to like to talk to me, though, but I would like to talk to you.
I don't want to talk about it.
You don't want to talk about it? Then why did you bring it up in the first place?
Call now for great advice from Dr. Ray. Now, don't you feel better?
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You thinking about homeschooling? Seton Homeschooling, 35 years of experience, pre-K through high school. They provide the books, the lesson plans, the counselors, the grading services, the tests. That's right. Well, my wife used Seton, some of our children. And I will tell you this, two of them got perfect ACT scores in verbal. And overall, the Seton students scored more than 100 points above average on the SAT. 27% higher on English and reading. It is a rigorous program. At least now, 1.3 million students are homeschooled. You want to give the very best to your kids? Trust me on this one. Go with Seton. It is a beautifully rigorous academic program. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org.
We need EWTN Radio for the reason that Mother Angelica founded this entire enterprise. She always saw this as a spiritual growth network. It was to be an enterprise in media that reached people in all aspects of their life. She saw this as a holistic approach to reaching the whole person in the middle of the world and bringing them truth and life.
Raymond Arroyo thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
If you're reluctant to call in with a personal question, you could always say, I know this person in my life. I don't like them. And then you can just avoid anybody thinking that is you. Jeff from Duluth, Minnesota, has an interesting question. As a matter of fact, this came up many times in my own thoughts when President Trump was being analyzed by many talking heads, and they had decided that his psychological personality emotional profile was deficient in so many ways, and it was especially problematic when you had people who were mental health folks pronouncing judgment and assessment. Hi, Jeff, how are you?
Hi, good afternoon. When I was growing up, my grandmother used to say, "You're too smart for your own good," she'd say. And
how can that be?
I use my intuition a lot, and I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and I went with my gut instinct early on.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, how can someone be too smart for their own good? The implication overthink it into trouble.
Exactly. Okay. I've had relationships where I've overanalyzed. But when it comes to voting for the president of the United States, I go with my gut feeling. I go with what I think is good for the country and what I feel good about the way they carry themselves, what they feel about our country and what their intentions are. And I think sometimes it's overanalyzed in the media, and it concerns me as we go forward for our, democracy. We're going to have to elect people to a lot of different offices. Men and women are involved in that now. And, at what point are we too smart for our own good to elect the right people?
That's what the media does. They overanalyze awfully, and they overanalyze through their own template. So as I sit and listen to talking heads, I am sometimes, as a psychologist, befuddled at how they've come to their conclusions and how they know so certainly what they know on the basis of their own speculation. Oh, do we lose Jeff? Okay. Something must have happened there. Let me continue that thought and go back to these other calls. So I think it is minimally problematic and maximally completely inappropriate for some person of a mental health type to look at a candidate and only on the basis of the media presentation of that candidate, what the media selects and chooses, what they show firsthand or secondhand about this particular person, and then to come to psychological conclusions. Oh, that's bad. That's real bad. Interestingly enough, though, there are studies that indicate that when somebody goes to a psychiatrist or psychologist or counselor type, within the first few minutes, a diagnosis is determined. And after that, the information that comes in, if it confirms that diagnosis, it is attended to. If it contradicts that diagnosis, it is either ignored or reinterpreted to fit. Okay, Mark from Albany, New York. I've been informed by Andrew and Eric that Mark had called before, and he apparently had disagreed with me about this whole aspect, but now he's having second thoughts. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm great. I just want to say I was wrong. I called actually twice. extremely opposed of your opinion of the COVID virus. I thought you were being irresponsible, just easy come lucky kind of type of thing. And my idea was, I guess you could say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So I was going with a ton of prevention is worth, 10,000 tons of cure. And my mom just passed away. And for the last over a year, I wouldn't even hug her or kiss her, not until she died. And I just pray that no one makes the same mistake I did, because now she's gone and I don't have that opportunity. So, and I never caught COVID. So this whole time, I could have been loving on my mom, hugging on my mom, and, it's too late. So I was so sure it's better for me to be sterile and not contaminate my mom. But now I just, can never go back in time. So I just hope people listen to your common sense or your wisdom and don't be super paranoid like I am. My mom, she had congestive heart failure and, pulmonary issues, and she did not die of COVID. She never caught COVID. But my point is that we were all so paranoid, my mom and myself. It was just, no touching. And that's how it was. And, I'm really upset about what I do,
Mark,
what I did.
Well, let me help out here, I think. First of all, I didn't minimize COVID. That I was talking about the balance of response, right? And even now the CDC is coming around and saying things like, well, we never really did have to wipe all the surfaces. And, oh, by the way, you really don't need a mask outside and et cetera, et cetera. So that kind of confusion was there. And my point always was, how balanced is our approach to all of this, given that it's a dangerous virus and given that it's very risky to the elderly? How balanced is our approach? Now, here's what I'm hearing from you. You have deep regrets that because of your concern, your fears, you didn't connect with your mom like you wanted to or should have. However, Mark, on one hand, I could see how you'd feel bad about that because you missed that opportunity. But on the other hand, you didn't do anything wrong. You acted with good intentions. You said, my judgment at the time, given what I was hearing, was that I needed to protect my mother above all things. Okay. So if in fact...
Hey, I'm on the phone. Go ahead and estimate my roof.
I've already done that.
Okay, just give me a 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I hope he's going to give you a good price on that roof. I mean, got storm damage or what? Okay. So, Mark, given that, you had every good intention with your mom to protect her. As you look back, you say, I should have judged the information a little more accurately as I look back on it now, because I realized that what I did, I could have done a bit differently. Okay, but that is not reason for guilt. That's not reason for self-blame. That is a miscalculation as you see it. You misjudged it. There's nothing wrong in that. If you say, I'm so sad because that last year I could have at least had some contact with my mom, then I understand that, of course. But to say somehow, some way I did a great wrong, I'm not willing to go that far from what you're telling me. You are like many who are scared to death, and you recognize that I need to, like you say, a ton of prevention. However, you're just now recognizing that ton of prevention can carry with it a downside. And if I could give you anything, my friend, I would say the guilt would not be warranted here. Not be warranted. Say some extra prayers for your mom's soul. That'll help. 877-573-7825. We'll be right back.
When are the most important times to celebrate the liturgy? According to the Catholic Catechism, Holy Mother Church has decreed that there are certain days throughout the year when the saving work of Christ should be commemorated. The Lord's Resurrection is celebrated once a week on Sunday, the Lord's Day. Once a year, it is also celebrated along with His Passion at Easter. Easter is considered by the Church to be the most solemn of all feasts. During the course of the year, the Church's liturgy unfolds the whole mystery of Christ, and it is made present to the faithful in every age. When the Church celebrates the mystery of Christ, there is a word that marks her prayer. The word is today, echoing the prayer taught by the Lord. It is also synonymous with the call of the Holy Spirit. This today, in God's time, always makes present the hour of Jesus' Passover, which reaches across and underlies all history. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The Wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Now, when Jesus was on earth, He taught us a great lesson. He taught us that He came for the sinner, not the virtuous. He came for you because you are imperfect, because sin comes easy to you, and sometimes you don't have the willpower to say no. But you see, if you understood the awesomeness of God and all His power and all His wonder, and He comes down to our level, He wanted to feel, how do you feel? I don't know anybody that loves anyone that much. And this imperfect being that's you and me and all of us, He did it for us. That's why you should never despair, because you're imperfect.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
It's your chance to be a star, your big debut. Don't mess it up. You can call 877-573-7825. John, Lincoln, Nebraska. Lincoln, capital of Nebraska. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you kind of touched on the topic earlier with another caller about the media and politicians, but I kind of wanted to point in the other direction and say, you know, like, what about all the, you know, people in the church, like the bishops and the biases that they have, you know, against people like Biden, you know, just mainly the pro-choice people. I mean, there's plenty of Democrats that support pro-choice. And it just seems to me like there's lots of people in the church that are just like one issue voters, and that's, it all comes down to abortion. And I just think that they're missing the bigger picture, and it's just kind of like they're just not seeing the whole picture. I mean, like, you know, the Democrats want to help out a lot of things, like, you know, building homes or, you know, government housing and stuff to help people get off the streets, you know, and people with maybe universal health care so that they could actually afford health care and maybe not have to go through with an abortion. You know, maybe that's the thing that's stopping them is their economic situation. You know, I mean, why would you want to have a family if it's going to cost you a fortune, you know, and you can't afford it if you can't get it?
All right. I got your picture, John. Let me respond. First of all, it isn't a bias. It isn't a psychological assessment. If the church says that at the very core of everything we believe is sanctity of life, nothing is more important than life. Nothing. So that if you have a politician or politicians who say it is our goal to make laws, to give money, to do everything possible to allow a child to be killed in the womb up to the day of birth, and even thereafter, if it is born from a botched abortion, to allow it to die, then there is nothing in the way of bias by saying we can't in any way support that. And we can't any way support a politician at a federal, state, or local level who would do that. The church has every bit that right, and so do individual voters. Now, the idea of the big picture, the idea that this is only one issue. Well, the question becomes, what kind of issue? Is this a minimum wage issue? Is this a border issue? Is this a taxation 39.6% issue? Or is this an issue of someone living or dying? Everybody at core is a one-issue voter, John. If I say to you, John, this particular candidate agrees with everything that you agree with, except he says that after age 75, there should be no federal health insurance of any kind for people over 75. They've lived their lives and weren't spending too much money on them. Would you say, well, okay, well, I don't agree with that, but that's just one issue? You probably wouldn't. You'd probably say, that's crazy. That's nuts. That's the one issue that would, in fact, negate all the other issues. And I think that's where folks are. Just one other point, too. And again, I don't want to get political here, but I'm tired of cliches. And the cliche is this, that somehow one party is more concerned about the little guy than the other party. I always find it fascinating when somebody says, you know what? I'm generous. Give me your money and I'll give it to other people. Am I generous or what? All right. Where are we at? Let's go. I want to go to Bo because this is going to be a good look back question. Bo says this is the middle child, and we got to establish that that may not be the connection. Hi, Bo. How are you? Yo, Bo. Bo there?
Oh, can you hear me?
There you
now?
Go. I got you, Bo.
Oh, there you go. All right. I got 3 boys. I got a 2-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 10-year-old. The 7-year-old, I have discipline problems with, or I don't know, maybe if our personalities don't really mesh that well, I guess maybe you would say. Well, like anytime I try and discipline him or make him pick up after himself, like I know you said, I think I got lucky with my first boy because he, for the most part, does what I say. And it seems like even my 2-year-old, he'll like help pick up, but like the 7-year-old wants nothing to do with it. And he's, why do I got to do everything all the time? And then I try and like discipline him and then he covers his ears, you know, or I'm going to bed or something like that. You know, I'm trying to figure out how to do it. Get our personalities in line and work.
Well, the way to do it, Bo, first of all, I know you say, it says here he's a middle child, and that's the way he is because he's middle child. Well, if you're worried about that, have another kid because then he'll be middle, and he won't be middle child anymore. That's just who he is. That's who your son is. You have a son who doesn't accept discipline like the other two. All right, that's the reality. Okay, that's no big deal. That just means you have to be a stronger parent. A lot less talk, a lot less arguing, a lot less nagging, a lot less reasoning, and a lot more action. So, for example, if it were me, let's use your example of putting something over his ears. You tell him to do something, and he puts it over his ears. I might say something like, well, son, now you're going to have to do it twice as much, and you're going to sit at the table, and you're going to write 50 times, I will not ignore my dad when he says something. You're going to teach him. You can't just put your hands over your ears like you're ignoring me because I ask you something. See, so what this 7-year-old is doing, Bo, is he's pushing on you hard, harder than the other two. He's probably not pushing on you that hard, but compared to the other two, it seems hard. And then what happens is you develop bad habits. You fight with him. You argue with him. You get frustrated with him. You yell at him rather than saying, hey, you know what, son? Go sit on your bed. I asked you, and you just ignored me. Go to your bed, please. Instead of doing a lot more of that, he frustrates you. Why doesn't he listen? Why is he always resisting discipline? Why does he have to be like that? Well, that's who he is. It's your 7-year-old kid. Well, why does he have to pout? Because he doesn't want to do it. Well, he shouldn't pout. Well, he is. So what are you going to do about it? You either ignore the pout, or if the pout is nasty, you do something about it. That's just a quick 2-minute primer here, Bo, on dealing with the kid. I mean, you want a quick consequence, just put him in a corner. If he doesn't listen, go to the corner. That's all. You don't have to think hard. It's right there. The corner's right there. You got four of them in every room. Use it. First time disobedience. You don't tell him a second, third, fourth time. You don't yell at him. Did you hear what I said? What are you doing? Now, see, that's useless. That's totally useless. Because all it does is it teaches him, I act bad, Dad gets mad. I rule. Dr. Rick.
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is Eucharistic Stewardship, bringing Christ to people and people to Christ. Question: do you believe Jesus to be truly present in the Eucharist? If you are Catholic, then your answer should be a resounding yes. The pinnacle act of stewardship through our Christian faith as Catholics is to bring Christ to people and people to Christ. As Catholics, the number one way to ultimately achieve this way of life is through receiving the Eucharist. The minimum requirement of receiving Jesus through the Eucharist coincides with the third commandment, keep holy the Sabbath, and thus receiving communion at Mass. But if you want to go above and beyond what's expected, then perhaps consider making daily communion a top priority. Or encourage others to make this positive change with you. The sacraments of Holy Communion and Reconciliation are two of the most powerful and transforming ways to bring you closer to the love, peace, and forgiveness of Jesus Christ. Another act of stewardship to bring one into communion with Christ might initially start by first bringing that person into the Catholic faith. Since the Eucharist is the focal point of our faith, your knowledge of the Eucharist is important. However, that's where priests in the RCI program can assist in explaining our faith and the role of the Eucharist. In summary, spend some time in prayer to discern how the Eucharist can play a greater role in a stewardship way of life for you or for someone you care. This is Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.
We interrupt this program for a special news bulletin.
I have no idea what emo is. All I think of is Emo Phillips. You know, Emo says things like, I prayed and prayed for a bicycle. And then I realized that's not how God works. So I stole a bicycle and prayed for forgiveness. Emo Phillips. However, I don't know what Emo is. Maybe Grandma knows what Emo is. Eric and Andrew, they knew. They told me. They tried to explain it to me. They kind of said it was goth light. It's some style that the kids got into many, many years ago, 20 years ago. Hi, Grandma, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I remember Emo Phillips, too. I wish it was more related to that.
I thought they were hanging around with Emo Phillips. I thought, okay, well, he's funny. What is it? What do you understand this emo to be?
Well, what I read, like, it's associated with being sad and kind of quiet and, like, my granddaughter showed up one day and her hair was cut different and dyed black, and my other grandchild, who's her peer, said, oh, she's looking emo, And he said, it's dark and sad. And she is sad a lot and quiet. And the hairstyle, like, covers their eyes. And she's dressing. So then I just Googled it and read some things. And she fits all the description.
Well, where's her parents?
I haven't. They're divorced, and I think that fits into it. You know, that's part of her sad, ongoing sadness, or at least her reason to be sad, you know.
Who has custody?
It's shared, and it's not on good terms, I would say.
So you see warning signs, keeping in mind that the peer group, especially a dark peer group, can have a lot of influence. So you see all these warning
exactly.
signs. Which parent would be more open to you telling them about it?
I think I'm on good terms. My son is her father, but I'm on good terms with the mother. I think I could talk openly to either one. My son already sees the differences, you know, and he's completely fine with, like, taking away her phone and those kinds of things. And he'll do it, you know. He doesn't hesitate on that. But, however, of course, you know, there's no, you know, the other parents certainly going to have their own set of rules and no control over that.
You might want to talk to one or both and tell them, let me tell you a little bit about what this group does, what they think, the kinds of emotional downturns that they convince kids to get into, especially given the exploding suicide rates among adolescents
yes.
and teens. You might want to let them know this is not necessarily a good thing at all, who she's hanging with, and what
right.
are they going to do about it.
Right.
It's going to probably be more than just taking her phone away. It's going to be supervision of who she hangs with. I remember seeing a
right.
study once that said the number one thing to get a kid to get rid of a lot of their antisocial type behaviors is to get rid of the peer group that they're hanging with.
Yeah.
And if she's hanging with a bad peer group, this peer group that says life is awful, life is terrible, life is black, life is bad, life is everything that we want to get emotionally distraught about, then they're going to pull her down. And I think...
Right.
You got to make it real clear to the parents this is not a good thing. Because I think what happens is the parents may have just had the idea of, oh, yeah, she's into that. I know. I don't like it. And I, you know, they're her friends, and that's who she hangs with. And, you know, kids do this kind of stuff. Now, I mean, if they play it down like that, you're going to have to try to convince them. That's what I would say. That's your role here, Grandma. It is.
Okay. Well, you confirm some of my thoughts and fears, you know. I just am afraid that it would get deeper, you know, she'll just go deeper into a dark, you know, kind
could,
of
could already be.
Exactly.
Sure. And it probably reflects a lot of life discontent, overall life discontent, and that's the peer group she's gravitating toward because it reflects how she looks at life. So,
right.
whoever you have the most influence with, talk to them and say, hey, come on, this is not something to play with. This is not something to look
right.
at as a phase. All righty.
Well,
thank you, dear.
I'm definitely going to do that.
All righty.
Thank you.
You're welcome, honey. Okie dokie. I probably best take a break, even though it's a soft break, and I can decide if I want. So, I want.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is? Go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Yeah, remember the old book, I'm Okay, You're Okay? Well, I have a version of that. I'm okay, you're okay, but your kid could be a brat. But fortunately, we can do things about that. All right. Anne from Maryland. What do I know about the Montessori School of Learning? Hi, Anne.
Hi.
You know, I don't know a whole lot of details. I do know the basic philosophy.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's making you ask? You got a child that you're thinking of putting in a Montessori-type program?
Well, first of all, do you still have a private practice?
Yeah.
You do? What state, where do you live?
Ohio.
Ohio.
Yeah.
Okay. I probably could find you if I went to Steubenville, right? Anyway, my husband and I decided we would like you to be help us out, because we adopt a lot of children, and don't worry, you'll have fun. You won't believe who my husband is, so I won't tell you right now. But this the reason I ask about the Montessori school.
Would I know who your husband is?
Oh, yeah, you know. Anyway, but I can't say on the air.
Now you got me curious. Now you got me really curious.
I know. I'll tell you when I get there. Listen, Dr. Ray, the reason I brought up Montessori school is because one of the things that happened to our children. You want to get a hold of some of those longitudinal studies they did on Montessori schools. I'll give you the gist of it. You are not supposed to put pressure on a child's mind before the kindergarten, 5 years old. Their little brains are absorbing the environment, and if you pressure them to learn numbers and letters like they do now, it stunts their emotional and learning growth. They did the studies, and they do fine in school up to about the seventh grade when everything goes downhill, and they found out the vast majority of Montessori kids never could graduate from high school because it stunts their growth. If they don't have that foundation, that basic time to absorb the environment without pressure, it catches up and it takes them down. Secondly, you were talking about writing. Well, one of the problems with that, Dr. Ray, is that they have no hand muscles. Forget the brain connection. They can't write. Now, I worked as a substitute teacher for three semesters, K through 12. The first thing I did when I came into a new classroom was to write a sentence in cursive and print on the board and ask the children to write it down for me. Then I collected the papers, and I went on with the teacher's lesson. In those three semesters, I could only find two children who could write legibly or print. And I know you probably heard they were going to take cursive out of the schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, why?
Well, Veronica, here, let me jump in here because you made some points.
Can I say one thing? It's the phones and the computers.
Well, of
wrong
course.
Hand muscles. Remember when we had penmanship first through third and we got drawing blinkies?
Okay, let me jump in here about Montessori. Another name for it is child-directed learning. And the philosophy of Maria Montessori was that you let the child explore, you let the child experience, you let the child direct what they're interested in and the kinds of things they want to learn. And I agree with you. I think in a lot of ways there's a looseness to it that it implies, you know, the kids automatically know what they are to learn and how best to learn it, and it plays down adult guidance. The idea of, you know, learning your numbers, learning your letters, et cetera, okay, somebody could make a case that says, look, if you don't want to mess with this when a kid's 3, 4, 5, it's going to happen quickly when he's 5, 6, 7. You could make that case. Regarding those studies that show an unraveling in the 7th grade, I would want to know what characteristics in the family lives, in the parenting, in the earlier education of the child that somehow manifested these struggles in middle school. In other words, if you say, well, this was because they had 2 years of Montessori when they were 3 and 4, or did they have 8 years of Montessori all the way up to middle school? You know, I don't know. I'd want to know those things. I'd want to ask a lot more questions and see what the variables are. Regarding you, Veronica, coming to Ohio, I have had folks who have come a long way, several states away, and what they do is they want the whole day. So they'll take 3 office hours in the morning and then 3 office hours in the afternoon. That's how they do it. That's okay with me. I don't have any problems with that. It's almost like an individual training session is what it is. It doesn't happen very often. But you can also do the Mother Angelica tour here in Canton, where I'm located. So I didn't mean to jump in there. And in fact, I'm sorry, I called you Veronica. Forgive me, I don't know why that is. I'm looking at the wrong place. It's Ann. I'm looking at the wrong place on the computer screen. Forgive me. Okay, where are we going here? Real quick, because I only got about 2 minutes left. Yvonne, Coldwater, Michigan. Hi, Yvonne, how are you? Maybe Yvonne got tired of waiting. Yvonne, did you get tired of waiting? Yvonne, going once. Going twice. Andrew's Yvonne there. Nothing? Supposed to be? All right. Let's go to Veronica, as I kept calling Ann for the last 4 or 5 times. Hi, Veronica. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Okay. You have a stepson and your daughter, 7-year-old.
Both steps.
Okay. And so I'm assuming that their dad has part-time custody.
Yes, we have 50-50 custody. I stay home, so I'm daycare, doctor's appointments, extracurriculars and stuff like that on mom's days too, until mom or stepdad get off work.
And you notice that the 7-year-old's mistreating the 4-year-old, and you notice she's much more agitated and willing to do this after she comes back from time spent at mom's.
Yes, it's kind of just developed over the past couple months. And I know they have a different discipline system over there and a little bit more of
loose.
An aggressive discipline
more loose
system.
Until they get frustrated and then they get mean.
Yeah, I went to the doctor with the mom for my stepdaughter, and the 3, almost 4-year-old, he was kind of, you know, being testy, bored in the doctor's office. And she was like, you need to do this or we're going to go and have a spanking. I don't agree with spanking. I never have. And it was just kind of out of nowhere almost. And in my opinion, but then again, I don't do that. And then my stepdaughter, she comes back, you know, and she just kind of takes almost that same mean, if you don't do what I'm asking you to do right now when we're doing the game.
Okay,
war.
I've only got about 40 seconds, so I'm going to have to jump in quickly, Veronica.
Okay.
My guess would be that the spanking is a reflection of the frustrated parenting. It's not probably the main discipline. It's probably a frustration discipline. And as a frustration discipline, it probably indicates that mom doesn't feel like she has real good control over the kids. And so she gets upset and she threatens to spank, or she does spank. So the spanking is probably a symptom of mom's parenting, which may be struggling. And that's probably why you're seeing more of what you're seeing, which is if the 7-year-old stepdaughter is not being disciplined well, calmly, consistently, firmly, she's going to get a little more unruly and she'll take it out on her brother. Sorry I had to cut you off. I ran out of time. Please feel free to call back. I'm Dr. Ray. I got to run. Thank you for joining me so much. Andrew Krucek, producer man, Eric Dumont, call screamer. All of you, walk with God. That's it. That is really the only walk.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit drray.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.